Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and features is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slowly, using simple sentences and a limited vocabulary. On the show today, we hear part of another What It Takes podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. And we close the show, as always, with an American story. Later, Brian Lynn tells about what officials in Cape Town, South Africa, are doing to deal with the drought there. But first, this report from Dorothy Gundy.
Large numbers of women consider the Me Too movement an important step toward countering widespread sexual abuse and wrongdoing. But this week, there has been talk of the possible harm the movement may cause. The discussion began after the publication of a story about a woman identified only as Grace. The website babe.net published the account. Grace told of her 2017 encounter with comedian Aziz Ansari. The article suggested that Ansari should be included in the growing list of abusive men in entertainment. Yet many readers, both women and men, believe the woman's encounter was simply an example of a bad date and a bad sexual experience. Ansari has said he apologized immediately after the woman told him about her discomfort during the encounter. He said he believed the sexual experience was consensual. But his career may already be damaged. Michael Cunningham teaches psychology at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. He said the Grace Ansari encounter is an example of a misunderstanding between two people. It appears that Grace wanted Ansari to treat her as a potential girlfriend to be courted over multiple dates, rather than a pickup from a party engaging in a mutually acceptable transaction, Cunningham wrote in an email. When he did not rise to her expectations, she converted her understandable disappointment into a false Me Too. Carol Lieberman is a psychiatrist in Beverly Hills, California. She said, "Too many women have joined Me Too too quickly and unthinkingly. Though they may have wanted to be in solidarity with other women, the stories of dates gone wrong or women scorned have detracted from women who have been raped or seriously sexually assaulted," she said. Online and in person, many women are talking about experiences similar to Grace's story. Encounters with men who seemed wonderful at first, but become aggressive or even criminally abusive when things became sexual. Sarah Hosseini writes about sex. She said the Me Too movement is big enough to include experiences such as Grace's. What she experienced with Ansari is not okay, but do we have language yet for intimate encounters that teeter on the edge of absolute sexual assault abuse? She asked. I don't think we do. Liz Wolf is editor of Young Voices, an organization in Washington, D.C., that publishes opinion pieces written by young people. Wolf has noticed a generational divide in reactions. Older women seem to think Grace should have been more vocal and assertive, or simply left Ansari's apartment. Younger women feel that Ansari should have read Grace's body language and listened to her more closely, and he was at fault for pressuring her. Among men, there are also many different views. Tahir Duckett is with Rethink, a nonprofit seeking to stop boys and young men from committing sexual assault. He says the Me Too movement is exactly where it needs to be as it continues to empower victims. This moment absolutely calls for a changed approach to dating, he said. It means paying just as much attention to body language as we do to words. However, Glenn Sachs, who writes often about men's issues, said the Ansari case supports his belief that Me Too is including trivial mistakes or misdeeds of the many in with the genuinely awful actions of a few. Warren Farrell has written such books as Why Men Are the Way They Are and The Boy Crisis. He suggested that women should bear more of the responsibility for beginning sexual interest, and he recommended training in schools for both boys and girls to view relationship issues from the other's perspective. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
The city of Cape Town, South Africa, has announced new water restrictions as officials warn the water supply could run dry in 3 months. The order, to take effect February 1st, will cut city residents' daily water usage by nearly half over current restrictions. Cape Town Mayor Patricia de Lille announced that total daily usage per person will be reduced to 50 liters. The current limit is 87 liters per day. The French news agency AFP notes that an average shower uses about 15 liters of water a minute, while a toilet generally requires about 15 liters per use. We have reached a point of no return, de Lille said in a statement. We can no longer ask people to stop wasting water. We must force them. Cape Town, on South Africa's southwest coast, is fighting the worst drought in a century. The city is home to 4 million residents. The mayor has identified April 21st as day zero, the date when officials estimate Cape Town will run out of its usable water supply. If no rainwater is received and current usage continues, the city says it will be forced to turn off the main water supply on that date. De Lille said many residents are not obeying the current restrictions, and those using too much water could be fined. She noted the government also planned a new tax as another way to punish people who go over the limits. In an effort to avoid running out of water, the city started several projects to build up its water supply in recent months. These included drilling deep underground to aquifers and increasing desalination efforts. I'm Brian Lynn.
And now, here is Alice Winkler with What It Takes. The subject today, music business legend Quincy Jones.
If you listened to popular music during the 20th century and the 21st, you have heard the work of Quincy Jones. He might have been the trumpeter or the conductor or the arranger when you heard him. He might have been the composer or the producer or the creator of the movie score. He might have been nurturing a band you love that he signed when he was head of a record label. But one way or another, I guarantee you, you have heard the work of Quincy Jones.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me.
Sitting down to pull this episode together, frankly, has been daunting, because covering Quincy Jones' life and career means covering everybody from Count Basie and Ray Charles to Frank Sinatra and Billie Holiday and Aretha Franklin to Michael Jackson and Paul Simon to LL Cool J and Mary J. Blige. It means covering 65 years worth of jazz and rock and soul and R&B and pop. We cannot possibly get to all of it, but what we will get to is who Quincy Jones is, where he came from, and what has made him the music machine he is. While I've been talking, you've been hearing snippets of music Quincy Jones ushered into this world. Before we hear his story, let's listen to just a little more.
Hey, Bob Rebop!
Hey, Bob Rebop!
Hey, Bob Rebop!
In the heat of the night, seems like a cold sweat creeping across my brow. Yeah,
they got a wall in China, it's 1,000 miles long.
Most important part of an artist's responsibility is to be a great observer. You know, if it's in human nature or nature, or just to pay attention. The rhythm of every music in the world is because it's taken straight from nature. The birds did not imitate flutes. It's the reverse. Thunder didn't imitate the drums. You know, it was the reverse. And so the elements of nature, when it comes from that, that's the most powerful force there is. Just like a melody. You can study orchestration, you can study harmony and theory and everything else, but melodies come straight from God. There's really no technique for melodies, really. And so that's, I guess, there's something about music that's always fascinated me, and I apply what the essence of that's about in everything I do, whether we do film or magazines or whatever it is. You can't touch it, you can't taste it, you can't smell it, you can't see it. You just feel it. It hangs in the air. It owns it. It dominates every time period, you know. String quartets at its own time period, and nobody can ever change it because it's hanging up there in heaven someplace.
The Academy of Achievement recorded this conversation in 2000. The interviewer was journalist Irv Drasnin. There's also a 1995 interview in the Academy's archive that I'll pull from for this episode. What I found so striking in both conversations was the range and depth of Quincy Jones' interests and expertise. He's had the creative output of a dozen people, literally, and yet he has still found time for deep dives into philosophy, politics, science, history, you name it. All that knowledge has fueled his outlook and his music, as have the dramatic, challenging circumstances of his childhood.
We were in the heart of the ghetto in Chicago during the Depression, and every block, it's probably the biggest black ghetto in America. Every block, it also is the spawning ground probably for every gangster, black and white in America, too.
To hear the whole podcast, go to the What It Takes section on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now it's time for an American story. Today we hear part two of A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Here is Shep O'Neill.
The creature with the spear was huge. There were many other similar creatures. They had ridden behind me on the backs of large animals. Each of them carried a collection of strange-looking weapons. The one with the large spear got down from the back of his animal and began walking toward me. He was almost 5 meters tall and a dark green color. Huge teeth stuck out of his face, and his expression showed much hate and violence. I immediately knew I was facing a terrible warrior. He began moving quickly toward me with the spear. I was completely unarmed. I could not fight. My only chance was to escape. I used all my strength to jump away from him. I was able to jump almost 30 meters. The green Martian stopped and watched my effort. I would learn later that the look on his face showed complete surprise. The creatures gathered and talked among themselves. While they talked, I thought about running away. However, I noticed several of them carried devices that looked very much like rifles. I could not run. Soon, all but one of the creatures moved away. The one who had threatened me stayed. He slowly took off a metal band from his arm and held it out to me. He spoke in a strange language.
Nictu maktuta sakota.
Slowly he laid down his weapons. I thought this would have been a sign of peace anywhere on Earth. Why not Mars, too? I walked toward him, and in a normal voice, announced my name and said I had come in peace. I knew he did not understand, but like me, he took it to mean that I meant no harm. Slowly, we came together. He gave me the large metal band that had been around his arm. He turned and made signs with his hands that I should follow him. Soon, we arrived at the large animal he had been riding. He again made a sign with his hands that I should ride on the same animal behind him. The group turned and began riding across the land. We moved quickly toward mountains in the distance. The large animals we rode moved quickly across the land. I could tell from the surrounding mountains that we were on the bottom of a long, dead sea. In time, we came to a huge city. At first, I thought the city was empty. The buildings were all empty and in poor repair. But soon, I saw hundreds of the green warriors. I also saw green women and children. I soon learned about many cities like this. The cities were built hundreds of years ago by a people that no longer existed. The green Martians used the cities. They moved from one empty city to another, never stopping for more than a day or two. We got down from our animals and walked into a large building. We entered a room that was filled with fierce green warriors. It was not difficult to tell that these were the leaders of the green Martians. One of them took hold of my arm. He shook me and lifted me off the ground. He laughed when he did so. I was to learn that green Martians only laugh at the pain or suffering of others. This huge warrior threw me to the ground and then took hold of my arm again to pick me up. I did the only thing I could do. I hit him with my closed fist as hard as I could. The green warrior fell to the floor and did not move. The others in the room grew silent. I had knocked down one of their warriors with only my hand. I moved away from him and prepared to defend myself as best I could, but they did not move. The green Martian that had captured me walked toward me. He said in a clear voice,
"Tars Tarkas! Tars Tarkas!"
As he spoke, he pointed to his own chest. He was telling me his name. I pointed to my chest and said, "My name, John Carter." He turned and said the word, "Sola." Immediately, a green Martian woman came close. He spoke to her. She led me to another building and into a large room. The room was filled with equipment carried by the green Martians. She prepared something for me to eat. I was very hungry. I pointed to her and said the word, "Sola." She pointed at me and said my name. It was a beginning. Sola was my guard. She also became my teacher. In time, she would become a close and valued friend. As I ate my meal, my lessons in the language of the green Martians continued. 2 days later, Tars Tarkas came to my room. He carried the weapons and the metal armbands the green warriors wear. He put them on the ground near my feet. Sola told him I now understood some of their language. He turned to me and spoke slowly.
"The warrior you hit is dead. His weapons and the metal of his rank are yours, John Carter. He was a leader of one small group among our people. Because you have killed him, you now are a leader. You are still a captive and not free to leave. However, you will be treated with the respect you have earned. You are now a warrior among our people."
Tars Tarkas turned and spoke softly. From beyond the door, a strange creature entered the room. It was bigger than a large dog and very ugly. It had rows of long teeth and 10 very short legs. Tars Tarkas spoke to the creature and pointed at me. He left. The creature looked at me, watching closely. Then Sola spoke about the creature.
"His name is Wula. The men of our tribe use them in hunting and war. He has been told to guard and protect you. He has also been told to prevent your escape. There is no faster creature in our world, and in a fight, they can kill very quickly. Do not try to escape, John Carter. Wula will tear you to small pieces."
I continued to watch the creature named Wula. I had already seen how the green Martians treated other animals. They were very cruel. I thought, perhaps this beast can be taught to be my friend, much like a dog on Earth. I walked close to the creature and began speaking in much the same way I would speak to a dog or other animal on Earth. I sat down next to him while I talked softly. At first, he seemed confused. I believe the creature Wula had never heard a kind word. In the next several days, I gained the trust and friendship of Wula. In a few short days, Wula was my friend and fierce protector. He would remain my loyal friend as long as I was on Mars. Several days later, Sola came to me with a look of great concern.
"John Carter, come with me. A great battle is about to take place. An enemy is coming near this city. We must prepare to fight, and we must be ready to flee."
"Sola, what enemy is this?"
"A race of red men who travel our world in flying machines. A great number of their machines have come over the far mountain. Take your weapons with you and hurry."
I collected my sword and a spear. I hurried out of the building and joined a group of warriors moving toward the end of the city. Far in the distance, I could see the airships. They were firing large guns at the green warriors. I heard huge explosions. The green warriors were firing back with their deadly rifles. The air was filled with the sound of violent battle. Suddenly, a huge airship exploded. It came down crashing near me. Red Martians were falling from the side of the huge ship, and then it exploded again.
That was Shep O'Neill with A Princess of Mars. Tune in next week for part 3. We have come to the end of today's show, but we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Hope you'll tune in too. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.